Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel as well. I'm Michael Finney. I'm a consumer reporter with 7 on Your Side, ABC 7 News, as well as KGO Radio, where I host a radio show, and I will be your moderator for today's program. Adam Levin is the chairman and founder of Identity Theft 911, also known as IDK 911, and co-founder of Credit.com. His decades of experience, including serving as former director of the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs, has given him unique insight into security, consumer privacy, identity theft, fraud legislation, and financial advocacy. He is a nationally recognized expert on identity theft, online security, and credit, and is the author of the new book, Swiped, How to Protect Yourself in a World Full of Scammers, Phishers, and Identity Thieves. Welcome, Adam Levin, to San Francisco.
Thank you very much, Michael. I normally would get up, except for the fact that I think that my life support would pull apart and I would feel like I was in the movie The Martian.
Right.
So therefore, yeah, so we'll just sit here.
Just stay seated.
I will.
And I'll drive. Why don't you begin by giving us an overview of your book and really your life's work?
Well, thank you. And listen, first I want to start by thanking the Commonwealth Club for allowing the both of us to come here and lower your property values. Secondly, I want to thank my friends from Credit.com who are here and my friends from Stanford and some of my friends from Berkeley who are in the same room with Stanford, and we can all sit together. And this is progress, actually. So this book is the culmination of probably 30 years of experience and 10 years worth of deep focus in the identity theft area, and then a whole lot of months of actually writing it. And I wanted to do this book because we're living in a new paradigm, and it's very important for each and every one of us to kind of grasp that. And that is that breaches have now become the third certainty in life behind death and taxes. And if you really think about it, in the past few years, over 1 billion, now think Dr. Evil, pinky to the lips, 1 billion files containing consumer information, personal identifying information, have been exposed to people who had no right to look at them, to get their hands on them, and certainly to abuse that information, which they have in fact done. So we are now sitting in a situation where it is inevitable, and I'm sorry to be Dr. Death on this, but it is inevitable that at some time in our lives, each and every one of us is going to become a victim of some form of identity theft, perhaps multiple forms of identity theft. So the old concept of let's prevent it, that's fantasy. This is something you can't prevent. Because even if you do everything right, and we'll talk about my definition of everything right, your information is going to be on a database, and when the wrong person, who is not an authorized person, gets their hands on that information, and if your Social Security number happens to be in that file, you will be looking over your shoulder for the rest of your life. So in the book, I talk about what I call the three M's, which is minimize your risk of exposure, monitor, and manage the damage. And I'm not going to be like the trailer that is the entire movie. I'm going to save that for our discussion with Michael. But the truth is, at this moment, there's a lot of stuff going on that is really bringing us all home to the concepts of privacy and security. The FBI and Apple, a presidential campaign where other than everybody wanting to blame China for everything, people are talking about building the Great Wall of Mexico, and it's going to be one heck of a wall with a big fat door. But everyone's talking about building the wall, but no one is focused on the concept of a cyber dome. Now, the reality is we're never going to have an impenetrable cyber dome. But unless we start to move in the direction where cybersecurity is a very serious topic of conversation, and that the government and business and consumers and the media all together understand the fact that this is a collaborative effort. We are all part of this. No one can shirk their responsibility. We're going to be seriously in the crosshairs of some very, very bad people. So with that,
before we start talking about the book, let's talk about current affairs with Apple and FBI. What's at stake here? I mean, it looks simple, security against privacy, and yet I think you're going to tell us it's far from simple.
No, listen, it's a very complicated subject, and one of the things that Tim Cook has said is it would have been a lot better if he didn't get up in the morning and turn on his television and find out that the Federal Bureau of Investigation had launched this motion in an effort to get them to basically hack into an iPhone. Apple did, on a number of occasions, offer assistance to the FBI with as far as they could go. But the real issue here, beyond privacy and security, is the whole concept of encryption. Now, for years, nobody wanted to talk about encryption. Nobody wanted to talk about data segmentation. Nobody wanted to talk about two-factor authentication. And the reason why we're in the mess we're in, and I talk about this stuff in the book, is because of the fact now that all the chickens have come home to roost. And this is an example where the FBI is saying, oh, come on, it's just a phone. Help us get access to this thing. We promise not to tell anybody. We're not going to do anything. We just need to get into this phone. We need to get access to this specific data. We can't get it any other way. And Apple is saying, okay, but how about there's this incident, then there's going to be the law enforcement agency standing behind that one, and the law enforcement agency standing behind that one. And then once all the law enforcement agencies and other agencies have lined up, then all the countries are going to be out there going, well, you did it for the U.S., and, you know, we're China. You got to take care of us here, or we're Russia, or we're Syria, or we're Iran, and the list goes on and on and on. And what he's really concerned about is, look, if you want to do something, this should not be the court trying to impose the will of Congress that hasn't even expressed its will in this situation. They are operating with a law that is 227 years old. It's even older than I am. And the All Writs Act, and there was a decision that just came down yesterday where a judge, I think it was in New York, basically would not allow the government to force Apple to allow them into a phone of a drug dealer by saying that, once again, that I am not persuaded that the All Writs Act is the way you should go. And there was another law passed a few years ago called the, and let me get this right, this is one of those great complicated congressional names, the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Agencies Act. And he said, when I took a look at this act, this really wasn't on point either. So you're still asking the court to be Congress. We don't want to be Congress. And Tim Cook said, why don't we just sit down and talk about legislation, but do it the right way and have this involve everybody? But if you're asking us to do something here, it is a very slippery slope, and we are very concerned about the fact that we're jeopardizing privacy. And with all the disclosures about the NSA and all the other things that's going on, we really don't need to go down this road unless this is a clearly defined outcome based on debate in the Congress of the United States.
Is our country ready for that serious of a conversation?
I'm concerned Congress can't seem to agree on the day of the week. And I was in Washington a few months ago, and we were meeting with the senior staff of one of the subcommittees of the House. And they said, you know, you will see some legislation come out this year. And in fact, it did. We saw CISA, which there's a lot of debate on what CISA really was or what it's really accomplishing. But they said, we're not going to really do anything on privacy yet because nobody in this place can agree on what privacy is. Imagine that.
Let's leave today and go back in history. Part of your book is the history of identity, the history of identity theft. I think most of us think in terms of identity theft as being about 15 or 20 years old. That's not the case.
No, people have been masquerading as people for years. And, you know, in the old days, you were identified by a sound. You weren't even identified by a name. And then when you had armies and you had the need to actually clarify who people were and what they were, then we suddenly had last names that were actual last names as opposed to the city you were from or what your vocation was. So it has evolved over time, and then ultimately we have DNA, which is enabling us to make more positive identifications. But think about it. When you're dealing in cyberspace, you're dealing with basically algorithms and numbers, and anybody can be anybody. And the issue is figuring out who is really the right person and who's masquerading as the right person and how people can take advantage of people. And it's really this evolution that we have to deal with now. And perfect example, there was a commercial not too long ago by, I believe it was either the Postal Service, the Postal Inspection Service. There was a woman sitting in a bus and a very nicely dressed man, suit, raincoat, briefcase, umbrella, came and sat next to her. And he started giving her the pitch that we've all heard about with the Nigerian scam letters, where it's like, you know, I am the lawyer for a family that's in exile that has krazillions of dollars, and we've decided you're the one that's going to be the residuary of where this money is going to go, and we want you to keep a piece of it and send it to the rest of us. And she looks at him and gives him kind of this snarly look and walks away. And the voiceover was, how come when they look you in the eye, you don't buy it? But when someone says it to you online, it's the truth. And this is the world we're living in now, is who is the person that's talking to you? Are they the right person? Is it an agency? Is it a business? Is it, hello, this is Peggy? These are the different things that we really face now. And that's why it's so important for people to be much more discerning and to understand the fact that we're going to get got. And the question is how we can find out about it as quickly as possible and then what we're going to do about it.
You begin your book talking about Alex from Target. A couple of years back, you may remember Alex from Target. I have a teenage daughter. Alex from Target made an appearance in our home. Not physically, but he made an appearance. Let's talk about Alex and the bigger picture that he brings up.
So Alex was this very nice-looking kid who worked at Target. And one day a young woman sort of floated by him and went, whoa. And so she took a picture and she tweeted it to someone who then went, yo. And then she tweeted it to someone else. And suddenly it went viral. And Alex, who was just a nice kid from a small town in Texas, all of a sudden had tens of thousands of followers around the world, and his fans ballooned to over 100,000 people. Literally, by the time he got from the cash register to his mother's car and she was taking him home, he was an international celebrity. And he did nothing. And now he then gets a tweet, hi, this is Ellen from Ellen. And it was Ellen DeGeneres. And he ultimately ended up on her show and a number of other shows. What Alex's skill was? He's a nice looking kid. But this shows you the power of social networking, social engineering, and how something can go viral and suddenly you can be an international star. Now contemplate the possibility with all of this. Companies are developing facial recognition software that's going to be available. You can literally be able to walk into a bar and just go around there and go, oh, wow, she's kind of cute. Yeah, what's her information? Or he's a handsome fellow. And so this is the whole story on this person. There's like no privacy now. And this is the world we're operating in. Mark Zuckerberg said privacy is dead. He wasn't kidding. And this is the direction we're going. I'm sure a lot of you saw the movie Minority Report. Well, contemplate the possibility of simply walking by a billboard, it's scanning your retina, and all of a sudden ads for whatever your favorite subject is, what your favorite products are, comes up in front of you. And then, by the way, law enforcement is also scanning and looking right for where you are everywhere.
The director of the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, a good friend of both of ours, Beth Givens, fabulous woman. She probably became most famous 25 years ago when she said, big brother isn't the problem, it's all the little brothers. You expand upon that. You say it's the big heist we spend too much time worrying about, and it's the hundreds, thousands, millions of little tiny robberies that are happening every day.
No, they are, and whether it's somebody capturing your image and putting it on Facebook and tagging it, or whether you have a situation like Alex where you're just minding your own business and suddenly you become an international, it should happen to me. Of course, a lot of people, I walk into a place and they go, are you the guy from The Voice? I say, look at me. Do I look like Adam Levine? But the problem that we have also is that because of, forgetting even all the databases that are being breached, which we're certainly going to talk about them at length.
Right.
Imagine all of the situations where you are a willing yet unwitting co-conspirator in the theft of your own identity. How many times have you picked up the phone and talked to somebody who you really didn't know, who you thought was from some specific place, and you lucked out? They really were from where they said they were, but they asked you way too much information about you. How many times have you gone online and given a website everything it asks for, including those quizzes? Now, I want you to think about the fact that when you answer a quiz on a website and you give them simple pieces of information, the street you grew up on, your dog's name, your favorite color, your favorite band, where you went to high school, where you went to college. Think of it as components of a nuclear weapon. In and of themselves, many of those components are completely harmless. Wow. But you combine them,
wow,
and they're lethal. And a perfect example, there are four kinds of, I call it the pantheon of ishings. There's phishing, dear cardholder, dear member. Spear phishing, dear Michael. Vishing, it's where you get a call and someone on the other end of the line goes, we're from your bank, and they name an institution, and it could have been one of the institutions with whom you have a relationship, credit. And they say, by the way, this is your credit card number, correct? And you go, why, yes, it is. And they go, this is your expiration date. You go, yes. They say, well, just to confirm you're you, could you flip over your card and just give us your security code? And there's actually been instances where people go, yep, you're a victim. Well, now we got to send you over to our security department. And the first thing the guy on the phone goes, what's your social security number? Now you've given them your credit card and your social security number, which effectively you've given them your life. Now that's phishing. Then there's smishing. I love all these things. Smishing is SMS. It's texting where you become an unwitting victim of a phishing scam. And that's where you get a text and it tells you that your account at a specific institution has been frozen. And the only way that you can unfreeze it is you have to click on this link and then you're going to have to answer certain questions so that you can verify yourself so that they can unfreeze it. And these are the unwitting things that we do where we think they're innocent, but they're not.
Let's run the numbers. You're like a mathematician with these numbers, Adam. What kind of damage are we talking about? How many people? How many dollars? How many years?
Well, you know, identity theft has been a problem that's been with us for a very, very long time. And you're talking about tens of millions of people who are victims of identity theft. Every year, now these are, if you follow the numbers, people will tell you it's anywhere from 13 to 16 or 17 million people a year, and all sorts of forms of identity theft, whether it's credit card compromise, bank account takeover, true name identity theft, medical identity theft, tax-related identity theft, criminal identity theft. You're talking about billions upon billions of dollars. Think about this factoid, and I said it in the introduction, is that over a billion files have been improperly accessed. They've been exposed through whatever means, through hacks, through disks containing data that fall off the back of trucks. They've had that. Where people would take laptops at home with tens of thousands of files on them and lose the laptop. You had a situation in the state of Ohio where an intern was designated by the state to take home this disk. and didn't realize that literally almost every citizen of the state of Ohio was on this disk. They lost it. Or how about the person with the Veterans Administration who lost the 26.5 million names on that database? So you're talking about that. In 2005, over 120 million Social Security numbers were improperly exposed. Think of all the healthcare insurers, Anthem, Premera, Excellus, the health providers that were breached, the Office of Personnel Management, 21 million Social Security numbers, 19 million background files with the most intimate details of people who were seeking security clearances, either to get them, to maintain them, or to upgrade them. Even people who work on airliners, stewardesses, pilots, the ground crew, anyone that had anything to do with an airplane had a background check. 5.6 million sets of fingerprints.
I know this one is very disturbing to you. Employees of the CIA, our spies, their information went out.
Absolutely. And think about it, not just the most intimate details of their lives, which could be used for extortion and bribery, but their Social Security numbers and their fingerprints. Now, you can change a lot of things. You really can't change your Social Security number. As a spy, you probably can. But you sure as heck can't change your fingerprints. And, you know, some people were saying it was China till the U.S. got China to agree to something, and then suddenly, well, maybe it's not China. And as part of an intelligence operation, they certainly, or whoever it was, got as much espionage information as they needed. But then the Chinese said, well, we investigated, and it was a criminal act. So what that translates into is once we're done with all of the information we need for espionage purposes, we're going to give it to the guy down the street, and he's going to sell it on the black market. So now you not only have to worry about bribery and extortion, you have to worry about becoming a victim of every possible form of identity theft you can imagine. If you're a government employee, contractor, former contractor, spouse, partner, friend, or even people who work in affiliated industries that needed to be investigated.
So much of it is luck or unlucky. You quote Hunter S. Thompson in your book. By the way, I give any author a much clapter for quoting Hunter S. Thompson, especially a consumer advocate. It's got to be the first time that's ever happened. You quote him from Fear and Loathing in America. Luck is a very thin line between survival and disaster, and not many people can keep their balance on it.
This is very true, and the problem is because of the enormous amount of information that's out there about each and every one of us. The only reason why each and every one of us hasn't become a victim of identity theft today is because they haven't gotten around to us yet. And, you know, remember one thing. You can change a credit card number. You make a phone call, they change it. They don't change your Social Security number. So for someone who has stolen that information, they can sit back. This is money in the bank. They will use it whenever they want to use it. I've seen cases where there was a young woman who became a victim of identity theft 9 years before she was born. How it happened is somebody invented a Social Security number. They invented it. They used it. She was born. Social Security Administration randomly assigned a number to her. Turned out this was the same number that someone had actually been using that was committing fraud. And that's just one example. Child identity theft, and you and I have talked about this on your show, is a huge problem. Kids, perfect target for identity thieves because their information is pristine. Nobody's looking at their credit. Nobody's checking their Social Security numbers. They're not. Their parents aren't. Some people can have literally a 15-year run before someone discovers there's a problem.
You say that all of us that are here this evening, all of us everywhere, are the day job for an identity thief.
Yes.
You say that they're building dossiers.
Yes.
I was caught up in a scheme where a gang was caught, so it wasn't used, but they took Michael Finney, television reporter's Social Security number. They took Michael Finney, high-tech company owner's, I think his credit card number. and in an address from Michael Finney, the Concord police detective. And they put it together and formed a human being, which apparently was just as good as each of us when you go to get credit.
The bionic person.
Yeah.
And that's called synthetic identity theft. And that's where you take three disparate pieces of information. And sometimes it's with completely different names. So they'll use your social security number, my name and address, someone else's date of birth. They'll put it together. Becomes a subfile in a credit reporting agency. And remember also that credit reporting agencies, they have no idea how old anyone is. They only can base what they know on the first credit application that someone files, and that's when they start to build a file. So you've had so many instances. There was the Day of the Jackal scam, which is where someone was crawling through cemeteries and looking for the dates on tombstones and zeroing in on those children, and they were using those names, and they were getting the birthday, and they were moving on from there. So there are so many creative people out there, and a lot of them are not really good people, but they're very creative and they're very persistent.
You were just talking about credit agencies. Here's a question. Please comment about contacting credit agencies about fraud on your credit report. The agencies seem to be difficult to communicate with.
Well, you know, the truth is that they got a lot of pieces of information they deal with, and there have been a lot of people that have been concerned about the kind of treatment they've received by reporting agencies. You know, the reporting agencies, you know, their attitudes, look, we're a library. I mean, we're not the guys that report the information to us. We only know what the subscribers report to us, that we will conduct an investigation. There are laws that are far more complex and sophisticated now than they ever were before. They're now creating electronic ways that you can dispute items on your credit reports. The agencies are becoming more forthcoming now. Of course, there have been settlements with attorneys general in many states, where even those bureaus that have been less than cooperative are now more cooperative as a result of this. But this is something to keep in mind with bureaus, and that is, you know, if I were to say the word to you, portfolio, the first response would be investments. But the truth is that each and every one of us has a number of portfolios in our lives. Credit is one, identity is another, and there are others. But just as you would hope that somebody would be the professional manager of your investments, you need to be the professional manager of your credit and your identity. You have to build it, nurture it, manage it, and protect it. And your credit report, and I know my friends from credit.com are now going to put their heads in their hands and groan, but your credit report can be either a resume or a rap sheet, and it's up to you. That means that you have to check that credit report. You have to be proactive. You have to be looking to see if there's information on that report that doesn't look right. And then you have to stand up. You know, a lot of employers now review credit report. They're not allowed to review credit scores, but they review credit reports. And there are a number of states that are passing laws. Senator Warren also introduced legislation in Washington to make it more difficult and be more limited with the categories that employers could look
We've
at.
We've done that here in California.
Right. And, you know, a lot of people go, well, your credit report really shows how you manage money, how you manage your finances. I think your credit report is actually an awareness tool that an employer also looks at and goes, are you willing to stand up for you? Are you willing to be thoughtful and to be aggressive when it comes to the information in your credit report? Because this really, to a significant extent, determines what kind of life you're going to live, unless you're living in a log cabin on Loon Lake and off the grid. And therefore, the question is, are you willing to review your report as often as you can get your hands on it? Are you willing to look at the information and see whether it's accurate or not? If it's accurate, that's one thing. Then you've got to come up with a really good explanation if you have negative information on it. But if it's inaccurate, you have to stand up. You have to, if you need to, literally force your way through with reporting agencies to get them to hear you and focus on the issue and help you get through it. But it is up to each and every one of us. We are the ultimate guardian of ourselves. We are the ultimate guardian of our credit and our identity. And this book is dedicated to this. Whether it's fair or not, it's life. it's life. And even though, you know, a lot of strides are being made and more information is being made available and credit scores are now more available than ever before and there is more access to credit reports than ever before, and we actually worked on legislation in Washington to make credit scores more available to American consumers. But fair or not, it is what it is.
No one's ever going to care as much as you.
No one. No one will care as much about you as you about your economic security or the accuracy of the information that defines you.
It's tough to be careful when they put your Social Security number on your Medicare card.
Oh, yeah, I have
one
of those.
That's what this question's about. And the audience member says, you know, we're told not to carry it around, but then I show up at my doctor's office, and I was like, where's the card?
Well, what I've done now, this is newsflash to identity thieves. What I did was I made a copy of my Medicare card, and then I blacked out most of the numbers, but a couple. And on the back, I say, here's my wife's phone number and my lawyer's phone number. Call them. They have the number. Or if you really want my number, you know, I will, you know, I'll bring it in if need be. Obviously, if it's an emergent situation, you know, they should call someone who is your, you know, your emergency contact. But don't carry that card around as it is. And it's important to redact it. Now, the government has now passed law, a legislation, that will remove that number from the card over the next few years. But just like the military said it was doing that, I hope we live long enough to see it removed from all the things it's supposed to be removed from. And certainly no one ever accused the government of moving rapidly. But it is up to us to do certain things to protect ourselves. For instance, you go to a doctor's office. Every time you fill out the new patient form, Social Security number, I say no. And I've had a number of doctors who go, well, I need it. We go, okay, why? Well, I need it to get reimbursed. I say, well, I gave you my insurance information. Also, in cases where you say to me, I'm not going to accept your insurance information, you have to get the refund, I can't escape your office without giving you my credit card number. So you certainly can find me. And they say, well, if you die, we're going to need it for your death certificate. I say, then call my wife. And if she's dead, call my lawyer. But, I mean, you know, I'm not going to give it to you. How many of you, there's a new thing now where they go, we want to speed your registration because you're a new patient. So what we're going to do is we've attached a blank medical history form to this email. Please fill it out and email it back to us. And I call them and go, are you on a drug? You never ask someone. Now, I did have one of those really great stories a few years ago, and I won't indicate which administration it was. Some of us at 911, we were invited to an event at the White House involving privacy and security. We got a form from the White House, and it says, on this Excel spreadsheet, please give us your name, your date of birth, your Social Security number. And I looked at it, and our chief privacy officer, our first response is, this has got to be a scam. This can't possibly be the White House. So we actually called the White House, and they said, why, yes, we sent this to you. And we said, okay, well, this answers the question for why America's in the shape it's in when it comes to security with government agencies. This is a problem that starts all the way at the top. Now, our president has done everything he can through executive order and his attempts working with Congress to come up with some kind of better security protocol for the government. Imagine that less than a year ago, we had a 30-day cybersecurity sprint. Now, this is after years of breaches and headlines, and now we do a 30-day cyber sprint, and it's designed to have two-factor authentication. Now, two-factor authentication, for those of you who don't know what it is you log into something, you're a privileged user, you log into something, and then the agency or the website sends you back a code so that you kind of know they're them, they know you're you, you enter the code, and then it allows you then to enter your password and go onto the website. They're now instituting that with the government. Finally, they say that I think over 70% of the agencies have finally instituted two-factor authentication. Are you scared? I'm scared. And these are the people that are supposed to be protecting us.
This is a Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Adam Levin, chairman and founder of IDT 911, Identity Theft 911, and co-founder of Credit.com. He's the author of Swiped, How to Protect Yourself in a World Full of Scammers, Phishers, and Identity Thieves. I'm Michael Finney, consumer reporter, 7 on your side, and a talk show host for KGO Radio. I'm your moderator for tonight's program. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio. Catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. Let's take another question from the audience. What do you do if somebody impersonates you on the internet, like on an internet site using your photo and your information?
Well, this has obviously happened a lot of times. You have to immediately contact the website that where it's being displayed.
Oh.
I mean, and that's not easy. I agree. You need to contact law enforcement as well. I mean, this is fraud. And one of the reasons why that's done is what we call catfishing. Catfishing is where people masquerade as someone else for the purpose of gaining the affection of another so they can find every possible way to rip them off. There's even a show on MTV called Catfishing.
Right.
And it is a serious problem. I mean, I did a show couple months ago where two women were there as guests. Both of them had been victims of catfishing. Both of them were professional women, and they had been taken to the tune of $60,000 each by these catfishers. And one catfisher not only committed fraud on a woman, but then reappeared as if they were an oil company executive who was communicating with this woman and took her again. It is a terrible thing. And again, this is because, once again, online, people want to believe. And they don't think about things like, is this person getting too lovey-dovey too quick? Are they asking for too much information too quickly? Are they asking me to do things that I would be out of my mind to do, like take compromising pictures or provide compromising information? And are they then saying to me, you know, if I only had a few dollars, I'm trying to finish this thing, I need to get a flight. There was a scam uncovered where two women in Colorado took people for over $1 million because they were masquerading as lonely deployed military service personnel. So, I mean, this stuff happens every single day.
Another question from the audience. My mom is 94 years old. She's active on the internet. Maybe looking for love. We don't know.
All right, Mom.
Can you speak about the vulnerability of seniors to identity theft? What are the scams?
There are so many scams. You have the grandparent scam where you get a phone call and the line is very scratchy. And someone is representing themselves to either be your grandchild or an attorney representing your grandchild. And they are asking you to send money because they've lost their wallet or they got arrested in another country, and they're relying upon you to save them. There are fuel oil scams. There are jury commission scams. There are IRS scams. Where they prey on everybody. Now, there's a case, it doesn't involve a senior, but involves a woman who was 8 months pregnant. And someone calls her on the phone and represents themselves to be from the Internal Revenue Service. And she had three small businesses that she was involved with. And they started telling her that she owed all kinds of money to the IRS. And they were sending someone to arrest her right away unless she would immediately give them money, that she would wire them, whatever they asked her to do. And she became so distraught, she just started crying on the phone, and she said, oh, my God, I'm pregnant. I'm so sorry. I'll do it. And the guy on the other end of the phone go, you're pregnant? Oh, my God, I can't do this. I can't do this. This is a scam. This is a scam.
And they
hung
really?
Up. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. But you know, with senior citizens, there are so many people out there that are preying on the fact that many seniors want to communicate with somebody, are happy to communicate, are thrilled to death that someone wants to communicate with them. There are healthcare scams out. There's Obamacare scams where they were getting information from people. They prey on your humanity. They prey on your desire to communicate with other people. That's why I suggest to many senior citizens that freeze your credit.
Let's talk about that for a moment.
Yes.
Because there's some effort involved here. Is it worth the effort? And go through the steps. You got to freeze it, unfreeze it, freeze it again, right?
Right. And you have to, you know, whereas a fraud alert, where you think you're a victim of an identity theft or fraud, you communicate with one of the three credit reporting agencies, and they will electronically put fraud alerts on files. And that means that before a creditor would extend credit, that they would authenticate that the applicant is really you. Now, there are a number of creditors that, despite the fact the law requires it, they don't really pay attention to it, like payday lenders and some folks like that. Then there's the credit freeze, where you have to communicate with each of the three credit reporting agencies individually. But they're making it easier and easier to do it. Now, 47, 48 states now permit and, in fact, encourage credit freezes. So the bureaus finally threw up their hands and went, all right, we're going to make it available to everybody. And if you're a senior, it's a much lower price than if you're not a senior. If you're a victim of identity theft, it could be free. It normally is $10 to free, $10 to thaw. But the purpose of a freeze is that no one, including you, can get access to your credit for the purpose of opening a new account without it being thawed. So that's why you have to remember that you froze it, because if you go someplace and they go, okay, well, you know, we're going to do a credit app, and they suddenly go, oh, no, we can't get access to it. There's something wrong here. Now, the great thing about individual credit freezes between the bureaus is if you go someplace and you're trying to get credit extended to you, what you do is you ask them, is there a particular bureau that they pull the credit from? Obviously, if it's a mortgage lender, it's all three. But if there's a bureau they pull it from, and then you can thaw it with that specific bureau, you don't have to thaw it with all three.
Because when you thaw it, then it costs you another $10 to put it back on again.
That is correct. And the other thing is, this is not the silver bullet for all kinds of identity theft. This will stop new account fraud. It's not going to help you if someone got their hands on your credit card or crawled into your bank account. It's not going to help you with tax fraud, medical identity theft, criminal identity theft. It may help you with child identity theft, provided that you've frozen your child's accounts. But it is important because it does stop one really big category of identity theft, which is new account fraud.
Another question from our audience. I hear from every possible Democratic personality asking for money during this primary season.
So have I.
Yeah. How do I know which is legit?
Well, first of all, if you're contacted by anyone representing themselves to be a Democratic candidate, go on the real website for that person. That's why I always say to people, never click on a link and just don't assume that someone is communicating with you. Like, for instance, someone calls you, leaves a message, leaves a phone number. That doesn't mean it's a real phone number. It could be the phone number of a fraudster. Also, when you see a number come out on your telephone, there are some people that are really good at spoofing phone numbers, but they doesn't necessarily mean that is the real person. So go to the real website or call the state Democratic Party or the local Democratic Party and confirm and, you know, say to them, how do I do it? What's the best way for me to donate if I want to donate?
Explain spoofing.
Spoofing is when you create the image or impression that is the phone number for a local business, and oftentimes the name will come up as if it's the real entity. I mean, there are people that have spoofed the Internal Revenue Service, and the IRS doesn't call you. They don't email you. A lot of banks may call you, but the minute they ask you anything other than to confirm specific account transactions, hang up. Never authenticate yourself to anyone unless you're in control of the conversation. And I have been at demonstrations where someone will go into the audience and say, tell me the name of your business and give me the phone number of your business. Then they will say to someone else, give me your cell phone number. And then they will do some technological magic. And within like a minute, the person in the audience will receive a phone call on their cell phone. And it indicates that it's coming from this particular business, and it's not.
Wow. This is another question. The TSA pre-flight has a clause that says, this is not a secure site.
Be very afraid when you say that.
And then it asks for personal information. If you can't trust TSA, now what? Who can you trust?
Well, you know, I give you the Office of Personnel Management breach. I give you the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department, the Education Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, CENTCOM. All of these organizations were breached. If you go to any website and you don't see HTTPS on it and that little lock, run. I don't care who it is.
How secure are the apps that store your computer passwords?
Well, now there's some debate on that. There have been some of those password services that have been breached. There are others that really haven't. So what you need to do is Google the name, look for reviews, which is always very important. Whenever you decide you want to do anything, look for reviews. Also go to websites where they really vet the app. I mean, Apple is a much better app vetter than any other app store that you will fall upon online. And again, very important to read review. Now, that doesn't mean someone doesn't create a fraudulent app. Not that I want to make you all paranoid. Creates a fraudulent app and then has a bunch of people write reviews that actually work for the fraudsters. I mean, that's not impossible to have because nothing is impossible. But it's all about doing your homework, check in with your friends. Say to people, have you had good experience with apps? Now, of course, there's a great story. The guys that do the flashlight apps, the FTC crushed several of them because what they were doing is your app would go on your phone, and once it got on your phone, it was sucking all the contact information out of your phone and sending it to the app developers. So, for instance, in the state of California, Attorney General Harris has been very aggressive in going after app developers and making sure that they all make disclosures. They tell you exactly what they're going to do with your information and how this app is going to work. Very important to read those disclosures. And, of course, the other problem is, of course, when you're asked to sign the I agree on the app, it's like the Constitution of the United States on steroids is being presented to you, and that's a problem. And hopefully we are moving toward an era where there will be more plain English versions of privacy policies. And, you know, the thing with the FTC, their position is, we're not going to tell you what your privacy policy should be, but once you tell a consumer and they agree to your privacy policy, you darn well better stand behind it or we're coming after you. Now, a perfect example was Radio Shack. Radio Shack swore they would never sell your information. That was the core of their privacy policy. In bankruptcy proceedings, what did they do? They sold all their customer information. So, you know, unfortunately, this is the kind of stuff that you have to confront. That's why the three M's. Minimize your risk of exposure as best you can. Monitor, manage the damage.
Early on, we talked about social media, but we kind of hopscotched across it. Let's bear down on that. A lot of us give a lot of information on social media.
Way too much information. Yeah.
Can we be on it safely?
Well, the way to be on it safely is lie. Use a nickname. You know, do you have to really give them your full birth date? I mean, it's fine if you want to get birthday greetings. Give them the month. Even if you want to give them the month and the day, that's fine. Don't give them the year. Do you really have to? And when you answer, could you really have to tell them what your high school was? Security question. I love this. When you set up a security question and, you know, you get to pick your mother's maiden name, your father's middle name, there's no law that says you can't lie. It's not as if when you set up your security question protocol that Facebook is going to conduct a massive background investigation to determine whether your mother's maiden name was Mrs. Orange or whatever you pick, or that your high school, you know, wasn't Sky High, whatever it is. You know, the only issue for you is if you're going to be very creative in the answers to the security questions, you have to remember what the answers are. Just like I say to people with passwords, what you do is, if you want to, if you say, I can't have 48,000 passwords, or I want 48,000 passwords, put them on an encrypted thumb drive. But then you have to remember two things. Where did you put the thumb drive? And what is your password to the thumb drive? So one of the things you could do is you could create a system for yourself. And that is, have a phrase that you like. Just make sure that other people who know you don't know this is the phrase you love, or invent a phrase. And then that's the core of your password. Then put a couple initials in front representing the website that you use it for, and then put a couple numbers behind it. Also, what you can do is say, look, I'm going to have three sets of passwords, and maybe only three or four. And that is one password I use for my social networking sites, one password I use for my retailing sites, and then a password I'm going to use for my email and for my, you know, secure sites like financial services websites. The other thing is, do not share passwords across all your sites, because if someone breaches you in one place, they're going to breach you all over the place. And do not use the word password as password. Or, as with the Ashley Madison breach, where 37 million people went down in flames, the most common and favorite password was 123456 7.
Not real creative.
Not really, no. No.
Another question from our audience. How long do you think it will be before credit card companies in the U.S. require passcoding for their credit cards? We've switched to the chip. In Europe, they use the chip and a passcode.
And a PIN, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And a PIN. The difference is they've got a completely different system behind their chip. I know that much, but do you see them going to a PIN here?
Well, you know, the argument they use, because we're now at chip and signature, because someone in the financial services community made a determination that the American public wasn't smart enough to remember a PIN code. That was actually, that came out. The other thing is, for those of you who think now that we have the EMV card, the world is a safer place, not really. First of all, there are a lot of institutions in this country that still haven't gone to it. Secondly, chip and signature is not as secure as chip and PIN. And ultimately, I think they're going to end up with, they're going to go to fingerprint. MasterCard, for instance, is developing a new thing. It's the selfie security system. And that is, you'll do a transaction online, then you will take a selfie, but you will be required to blink as proof of life. Somebody has already,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, somebody has already done a CGI and cut out, and they're blinking behind this picture of somebody else. So, you know, never underestimate the creativity of hackers and identity thieves.
Another question, can a hospital require a photocopy of a driver's license in order to release medical records?
They should, but then the issue is, are they securing it properly?
Right.
You know, now, my hospital, what they do, and this is in New York, where they now do the palm scan, which at least is a bit more secure. I mean, when you put your hand on the device, it feels like you're in a dime store. It's this little plastic thing. But it seems to where they go, yeah, you are who you're supposed to be. They never have my address right, but I am at least who I'm supposed to be. So,
when I've done reports on dumpster diving, where we go to the back garbage cans of stores, banks, and professionals, I find all of their clients' information readily. Never any of theirs.
Yeah.
So everyone is very concerned about their privacy, but not even their clients.
No. The problem is that many businesses are more concerned about intellectual property and trade secrets and their data than they are about what I think is their most precious asset, which is the personal identifying information of their customers and their employees. And You know, the problem is when you hear about a big breach and then there's a momentary blip in the business of that business. And there are all sorts of surveys where consumers say, if a business is breached, I'm never going back. And huge majorities say that. And yet they all go back. They all go back. And you know, businesses now are starting to understand that really is a serious problem because the penalties, the fines, the class action lawsuits are getting uglier. The numbers are getting bigger. You're starting to see $10, $15, $20 million judgments in a lot of these cases. Now, for these billion-dollar companies, it's $20 million bucks is a cost of doing business. But you saw with Target, the CEO walked the plank. You saw with Sony, the CEO walked the plank. You know, this is going to happen more frequently. It is now making its way up to the boardroom, where board members are understanding that they could get sued by shareholders as a result of the company not properly protecting data and then becoming a target of the suit. The Attorney General of Texas is now the governor of Texas because he made a career out of sending his people around behind all of these different stores, crawling through their dumpsters, checking to see if they threw files out, and then fining them rather excessively large, but not inappropriate fines for what they did.
We've been talking about internet security, and when you watch news or read the New York Times, you'll be hearing everyone talk about the Internet of Things.
Yes.
So now all of a sudden, we're going from data moving around that can hurt me to like real stuff moving around that can hurt me. Right?
No, and contemplate the possibility that your toaster could be spying on you. Or your dishwasher, or your television, or your security system, your HVAC system, the baby monitor in the house. Hello, Barbie. There was a whole scandal about that. VTech, where they got breached and the files of 6.4 million children were part of that.
Oh, right.
And it was the name, the age, the gender, chat logs, because their parents were being encouraged, you know, chat with your kids, have it as part of the VTech thing. Also photographs, which brings us to all the other issue of geotagging photographs and disable location services on your phone. So when you take a picture of your new piece of art or your car or your child, that someone who's very clever couldn't look at the code on the photograph and go, I know who that person is. And I know where they are. So I know not only what they have in their house, but I know what kind of vehicle I need to drive to that house to steal it and take it away. But the Internet of Things is an area of serious concern. And more products and services are actually, you know, putting in their instructions, here's how you disable this thing. So it's important. They all come with default passwords, many of which are found on websites that hackers frequent. So what you want to do is you want to read the manual, find out, you know, how you can change the password, make it your password, make it long and strong. Also change the password on the router in your home, which is the conduit. Yeah. But imagine the fact that all of these different items, which are designed for the purpose of, you know, let's take the data and report back to the manufacturer so we can make a better product. Think about this. There is now a smart mattress cover, which can figure out when you go to sleep, what the right pressure is on the mattress to help you go to sleep. It can turn off the lights, turn down the heat. Eventually, when you wake up, it will turn on the coffee, turn up the heat. I mean, this is how advanced things are getting. And, you know, it is known as the Internet of Things. It's also known as the sensor net, which brings us back to the movie Minority Report, where it's going to be able to, you know, read your retina and then present things to you. This is the world where everything we do, we have to get used to this, is being tracked, gathered, stored, and disseminated. And half the time, we don't even know they're doing it. So there are people that when some of the big retailers were breached, they go, I never shopped at that store. Well, you didn't know that you were on a list that store bought in order to market to you what they do.
Wait a second. So there's a retailer or a business out there that you consider untrustworthy with your private information.
Can you imagine?
And it may already have bought your private. Even though you choose not to do business with them, they already have it.
They do. They do. And also, think about all the loyalty programs that you participate in, and they ask you for your zip code, and then they ask you for more information. And they almost make it as if it's prohibitive for you not to be a member of the loyalty program, because when they give you your receipt, they show you how much money you just saved being a loyal customer. And you're going, oh my, why would I pay 30% more not to give them my information? Well, think about how much it's really costing you when you give your information. So I have friends who go, no problem. They lie about their phone number. They lie about their zip code. And they give it to the retailer. And also, you know, when you go to retail and they say, you know, check the box, can we send you email? No, don't do that. Don't do that.
Voice control, back to the Internet of Things. Are you concerned that burglars can walk up to your house and just start yelling, turn off the alarm?
Yeah, I am. I am. And there's a new thing now where there is a concern raised that some institutions are going to voice authentication, but there are ways to modulate that authentication. Now, imagine also if you're somebody who has stored this voice recognition information on their systems, and the systems are breached. And now they have your name, they have your address, they also have your voice. And as more and more institutions go to voice recognition, this could be another problem, too. So, again, it was not my desire to come here tonight and now make everybody want to go home, lock the doors, and crawl under the blankets. But, the goal here, and we try to do this every week when we talk together at KGO, is to understand that, you know, this is the world we live in now. We got to kind of take where we are. We've got to fight to push government to protect us better. We've got to be more demanding of businesses that if they don't protect us, they're not going to get our patronage. And that, you know, only over time as we stand up and as we also move to more biometric authentication features, which may well be your heartbeat. It may be the way you actually hold your mobile device, the pressure that you exert on the keypads. All of these different things are being developed, and enormous innovation is going on. And one of the whole arguments that Apple is making is if you make it that easy to force us to give you information, you could well be stifling innovation and be putting a chill on technology development in this country. And that's why that has to be part of the debate, and Congress has to debate it. And that's why we have to demand that people running for president in 2016 talk about more than a wall.
We're coming up to the end of the program, so we have time for one last question. And it's an important one. Are we allowed for free to check our credit report? How?
annualcreditreport.com. You're entitled to a free copy of your credit report from each of the three agencies. There are sites like, I have to give a small plug to credit.com, where you can go and get a free overview of your credit, as well as scores that are updated monthly for free. And, you know, as much as I'd like to say we are the game in town, we're not the only game in town. And but it's also the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, compliments of Senator Warren, is encouraging financial institutions to make more credit score information available. The last thing I want you to think about, though, when you look at your credit score, is think of that wonderful line from Pirates of the Caribbean, where they talk about the pirate's code. And they go, well, it's not exactly a code. It's more like a guideline. That's the same thing when you look at a credit score. Remember that at any moment in our lives, we have somewhere between 50 and 100 active credit scores going on because of all the different baskets we're in and the different tweaks to the scoring models that are out there that for different lenders. But if you look at your credit score as an important guideline, that it can be helpful. And remember, it is so important to make that score as high as possible, because the less money that you pay for money, the more money that's available for you to build wealth, to create economic security, and get what you want at a price you can live with.
Our thanks to Adam Levin, chairman and founder of IDT 911, Identity Theft 911, and co-founder of Credit.com and the author of the book we've been speaking about tonight, Swiped, How to Protect Yourself in a World Full of Scammers, Fishers, and Identity Thieves. I'm Michael Finney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.